everyone, and welcome to Classic Gaming Today, where we take a look at the gaming experiences of the past through the eyes of the present. I am your host, Tony, and today we're going to have our next Sounds of the Classics episode, this one focused on point-and-click adventures, Volume 1. We're going to talk about those songs and titles in just a couple minutes, but first, as is usual, just a little bit of housekeeping up front. This is episode number 80. I'm excited to be here. I hope all of you are as well. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle at ClassicGamingT. I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. We have discussions. We do gaming challenges. We have prizes and all sorts of stuff. If that sounds like a good time, definitely check us out over on Discord. I'd also like to encourage everyone to check out our Patreon. It's patreon.com/classicgamingtoday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a bi-weekly Patreon-exclusive podcast called Expansion Pack, patreon.com/classicgamingtoday is where it's at. I'd also like to give a shout-out to our Pantheon patrons. They are ISO, Rich Senewald, David Morton, Sam Twardowski, Sean Marshall, and Steve Novoselic. Thank you guys for supporting the show. Thank you all for supporting the show, whether you contribute monetarily or simply listen on a regular basis. I truly do appreciate all of the support. For anyone who may be new, welcome. This is usually the part of our episode where I go over the anatomy of an episode, where we talk about the history of the game in question, the historical context, how the game was made, why the game was made, and then move into a pseudo-review kind of section where we talk about the graphics, sound, music, narrative, and story, if the game has one, playability and controls, and overall feel before reaching a verdict as far as how well the game holds up today, and then assigning each game to one of several categories, with the Pantheon being up at the top, followed by Golden Oldies, Mediocre Mentions, and Footnotes, which are really best left in the annals of history. The thing is, though, this episode is not one of our traditional episodes because it is a Sounds of the Classics episode. This is where we listen to the music behind the games that we all know and love. And specifically, I have chosen tracks that mean something to me from games that mean something to me. And we're going to listen to that music. And along the way, I'm going to tell you why I chose those particular tracks and why those games mean something to me, why I have an indelible memory of those games and those experiences. Now, before we begin this episode, I do want to mention that we're going to have another Sounds of the Classics episode in 10 episodes. We've been doing this around every 10 episodes, and our next one is going to be a listener grab bag episode, which means rather than me picking games and music that mean something to me, it's going to be up to all of you to send in your selections. Send me the games and the music from those games that mean something to you, and send me why it means something to you. And you will get your shot at actually being on the show. Send me recordings, send me written text, it doesn't matter. We will get your content out there. If we get an overwhelming response, we may have to do a few different volumes of the Listener Grab Bag episodes, but I do want to open this up to everybody. So just once again, if you do want to send me in something for that next episode, which is going to be episode 90, so we have some time, we have a couple of months, but if that's something that sounds interesting to you, make sure you send me a note either via email at classicgamingtoday@gmail.com, on our Discord server, or even out on X with the handle at classicgamingt. I know that might sound repetitive, but I wanted to make sure you had that info front and center if this does sound like something you would enjoy doing. With that out of the way, we're going to get started and go into our first song. So sit back, relax, and listen to this one.
We'll be right back.
When I was younger, and even into today, I have always fancied myself a fairly good puzzle solver. I love trivia. I love playing games or looking at logic puzzles and doing things that really tax my brain. So when I was younger, and I heard about this game series, and in particular, this individual game called The Castle of Dr. Brain, which was by Sierra Online, I knew I had to play it. This game presents you with a series of increasingly challenging, logic-based kinds of puzzles. There's math puzzles, there's kind of pseudo-computer programming, there are mazes, I know nobody likes mazes, myself included, but there were a lot of different puzzles in this game, and the fact that Sierra Online, which was prominently more traditional point-and-click adventure-centric at this point, was releasing a game that was very much not your traditional point-and-click adventure, really intrigued me. And looking at it, I thought, oh, well, these are just a bunch of puzzles, the kind of puzzles that I enjoy doing anyway. I should definitely get this game and give it a go. So, of course, that is what I did. And then I went out there and I played the game, and boy, was it so much fun. Now, around this time, I wasn't one of those people that automatically cranked the difficulty settings up on games. This was a time before I was going out to kind of very hardcore challenge myself in these games. And even today, I usually play games on normal. But as I was playing The Castle of Dr. Brain, I had originally left it on its default difficulty. And as I'm playing, I'm thinking, oh, you know what? This is pretty darn easy. I'm kind of flying through it. Now, I was young still, but like I said, I had been playing a lot of different puzzles, or at least experiencing a lot of different puzzles and different puzzle books and kind of testing myself along the way. And when I sat down to start playing Dr. Brain, I thought, that is a little bit easy. So I went out into the options and I noticed there was a difficulty slider. And I said, you know what? Let's crank this thing up to the top. Well, that, if anybody's played The Castle of Dr. Brain, there are some puzzles. A lot of them you can still do at a higher difficulty level. And it's been years since I played The Castle of Dr. Brain last. But I remember cranking the difficulty up, and as younger me sitting down to play the game, oh, that was a little bit of a different experience than having the default difficulty settings. And I remember the one that I think was most difficult, or one of the more difficult puzzles at the time, was the magic square. I think it's called a magic square kind of puzzle, where you have to make the vertical, horizontal, and diagonal lines of a bunch of number squares equal each other. So if you're trying to make everything equal, say 15, you have to have every row, every column, every diagonal has to equal 15, and you cannot reuse numbers. So if you're using the numbers 1 through 9, let's just say, one through nine, let's go with. If you're using that, then you have to make sure that every single row, column, and diagonal only uses one of those numbers in the 9-square configuration, and you have to make sure that every row, column, and diagonal equals 15. When you have the lower numbers, that makes perfect sense. When you start getting up into higher and higher numbers, the way to solve that puzzle, at least, and there is an algorithm, by the way, but back then I didn't know it, is a little difficult. And I will say I spent some time on that one. I actually remember getting a sheet of paper out and drawing out this magic square and starting to play around with the different numbers and put down the different numbers. How do I figure that one? What does that one go to? How do I get that number to equal whatever? It was a lot of fun, but it was also pretty darn challenging. And Dr. Brain was, you know, it's kind of zanier than most Sierra games, too. It almost had a LucasArts feel from an art style perspective, and I was there for it. Like, I loved Dr. Brain. I actually, because I enjoyed The Castle of Dr. Brain so much, I went out and I bought other games in the Dr. Brain series. There was the Lost Island of Dr. Brain, I think it was called, or maybe just the Island of Dr. Brain. And then there was the Lost Mind of Dr. Brain. And I remember playing those even and just having a ton of fun. And like I said, these are all logic-based puzzles. These are not the kind of things where you would see environmental kind of interaction or observation being needed to solve any of these puzzles. But for somebody who always enjoyed those logical tests of brain function, I guess I could call it, Castle of Dr. Brain really appealed to me. And when I beat that game at the highest difficulty setting, I thought to myself, hey, I'm pretty darn smart. And I thought that just to myself, because saying it out loud to anybody would be extremely obnoxious. But I remember feeling a sense of accomplishment when I beat that one, and it will always hold a special place in my heart. Moving on to our next game. Let's see if anybody can guess where this song comes from. Speaking of logic-based puzzles, this is from the seventh guest. Oh, the seventh guest, how I both love and hate thee. It is one of those games, and if you've never played seventh guest, the general concept is you are in what is effectively a haunted mansion, and there's some backstory that goes into why that is. But you're in this haunted mansion, and you are tasked with effectively getting out of the mansion. And to do that, you have to navigate around the different scenes, the different floors, the different rooms. You've got to solve a bunch of puzzles to try to figure out what's going on, and then ultimately, hopefully, escape from certain doom. Now, Seventh Guest is a logic-based game, or a logic puzzle-based game, very similar to Castle of Dr. Brain, in that there's not a whole heck of a lot of environmental interaction here. Now, you know what, I take that back, because there are some puzzles that have clues hidden within the environments that, if you notice what those clues are, will make solving certain puzzles a whole heck of a lot easier. The big thing about Seventh Guest, and why I remember it fondly, is not necessarily for the puzzles, though I will say there are a couple of puzzles that we'll talk about that have a level of infamy in my brain, as opposed to being something that I particularly enjoyed. But the reason I enjoyed Seventh Guest, and the reason why it's on my list, is because it was one of the first full motion video games that I played. Now, longtime listeners will recognize that I love full motion video in games. I love every single FMV title, whether it is the corniest of corny or actually something really good. I just enjoy full motion video in interactive entertainment. And The Seventh Guest was one of the earliest examples of full motion video in a computer game. It wasn't the earliest example, but it was one of the ones that really sold CD-ROM technology as a medium that was going to be used for games in the future, because the massive storage capabilities of a CD-ROM disc just made it so that you could have advanced audio and video and everything else that previously was simply imagination. You couldn't do that kind of stuff before CD-ROMs. Seventh Guest was one of those kind of system sellers, so to speak, in a console perspective. Only in this case, it wasn't really selling consoles, it was selling CD-ROM technology. So Seventh Guest was interesting to me because of that fact. The graphics looked amazing, the full motion video cutscenes, a little grainy, but hey, it's full motion video, that means I automatically love it. So as I played the game, and like I said, I enjoy logic-based puzzles, probably more so than many people, just because it's one of my things. So as I'm playing the game, I would eventually hit a couple of puzzles that absolutely stalled my progress. One of which was the soup can puzzle. Now, the soup can puzzle was, you know, even knowing the solution now, I don't like the solution at all. And as I usually do, I'm not going to give any spoilers here in case anybody wants to go out and play it. But the soup can puzzle was, in my opinion, just such a crazy leap of logic to try to get to the solution that I immediately cursed every single developer associated with the game because of that puzzle. It was just one of those things where I don't think it was a well-designed puzzle at all. All of the other puzzles, or at least most of the other puzzles in the game, were solvable by careful observation of the puzzle itself or just knowing some logic-based things. The soup can puzzle, even the hint they give in the game, by the way, because you can get hints in the game. Even the hint they give, I don't know. It didn't work for me. It was a really poor hint. And maybe that's just me. This was just one that I couldn't get. One of the other puzzles I really didn't like, and I am almost loath to call this a puzzle because it's simply an exercise in torture, is the maze sequence in the game. You know how you don't like game? Well, I'm going to talk about myself. Maybe other people like mazes in games. You know how I don't like mazes in games because I literally just told you? Well, the seventh guest has one of the worst mazes in video game history, from my perspective. I have actually tried to play this one, and I had to map it out on a piece of paper, which I know is not uncommon for classic titles to have to actually use notebook paper and pencils and pens and whatever to actually draw out maps. The thing is, the reward for doing so, I just didn't feel it. I felt like it was pure padding. Why the heck would they have a maze in this haunted mansion thing? You talk about the logic in games and why certain things exist in game worlds. I love when games have a very logical, at least in the perspective of whatever the game's world is, a very logical definition of what it means to exist in the game. If you were in a game where mazes were the thing, and there were mazes in that game, okay, cool. But Seventh Guest, there was no reason for the maze, and I think that it really did just act as padding because it took a while to get through. Even with mapping it out, it took a while to get through. The interesting thing is, apparently, and I found out about this out on Discord, apparently there is a clue to the maze that lets you kind of see what the path through it is, which I never found when I was originally playing through the game. And I guess as a result, I tortured myself unnecessarily. So kudos to the developers for actually having a clue in there that allows you to progress through the maze more easily. Without that clue, though, it's pretty darn painful. And then finally, one other puzzle that I want to mention, and this is not a Seventh Guest episode, it's just as I'm thinking about it, a lot of memories are flooding back. The microscope puzzle, where you have to beat the computer in a game of, I guess, what is the game called, the formal game? It's kind of like Othello. I don't know if that is the formal name of it or if that was like an offshoot of what the real baseline game is. But basically, the goal is you have, or the concept is you have a set of white markers and a set of black markers. And then as you place your markers around your opponent's markers, their markers turn to your color. The goal is to get as many of your pieces on the board as possible. The thing with the microscope puzzle is that the artificial intelligence was so difficult depending on the power of your computer. At least as I understand it, the power of your computer would actually drive the AI to think ahead more or it will perform better than other computers, and depending on that power, the game could become almost impossible to beat. And I just remember racking my brain and trying all sorts of different combinations to try to get the AI to lose. I did eventually beat that one, but I would be lying if I said I didn't have some battle scars because of that. Regardless, Seventh Guest still maintains a special place in my heart as one of my earliest full motion video adventure games, as well as one of those games that has a ton of puzzles, most of which I enjoyed, some of which made me really reconsider life's decisions. Anyway, we're going to move on to our next game. Let's listen to this one, see if you can guess what it is. Before we talk about this one, I have to give a little bit of perspective. I have not played a Police Quest game in probably almost 30 years at this point. But what I can say is that my memory of playing the Police Quest series is so, so nostalgic to me. And this particular track comes from Police Quest 3, The Kindred. So let me talk to you about Police Quest and my own personal journey there. When I was younger, I never particularly wanted to become a law enforcement agent of any kind. I didn't want to become a cop. I didn't want to become anything like that. But I was still intrigued by the concept of policing. And when I found out about this series, this game series by Sierra Online called Police Quest, I thought to myself, well, this sounds like kind of fun. Maybe I should get it and give it a go. And that's exactly what I did. And what I found out was that the procedural aspects of being a police officer, for whatever reason, for younger me, was completely enthralling. This might sound like a weird thing for a very young person to really get enthralled by. But when I bought Police Quest, I spent hours reading the manual that came with the game. And for anybody who hasn't played it or hasn't seen the manual, it has a bunch of police codes in it. So you might say, well, how could you spend hours reading a manual? It wasn't necessarily the reading of the manual that took hours, but they had a bunch of different police codes in it that corresponded to the different radio codes that police officers would use when they communicate with each other, kind of as a shorthand kind of thing, like 10-4 and things like that. Well, I spent a significant amount of time memorizing all of those police codes, my thought being that it was going to improve my performance in the game. And I guess ostensibly it kind of did, maybe. I don't know, that was probably entirely unnecessary. But I found it engaging, and I just loved learning about those police codes. I also loved learning about the rest of the game, and ultimately this actually drove me to learn more about policing in general and some of the other procedural aspects. And it's funny, because I didn't even really care about the act of policing. I mean, obviously, it's good when you have a positive law enforcement agency that's out there, but I really enjoyed the procedural aspect of things, the things that you needed to do, or at least the game told you needed to do every single day, otherwise you would face certain death. And honestly, the Sierra games, there were some pretty ridiculous situations. Like, if you don't check every tire in your car every single day, ooh, you could potentially die. Did you know that if you didn't check around your car every single day as a police officer, you may in fact die every day? Wow, I didn't realize that. Now, whether that's true or not is, I guess, a question for a different debate. But the game really went heavy on the procedural elements there, and that was driven primarily because the designer behind the game was a real police officer, a highway patrolman named Jim Walls, who took all of those procedural elements and added it to the game. Now, in true Sierra fashion, if you failed any of those procedural elements, you would, in fact, fail the game, whether that was actual death, or you simply would fail and get a game over kind of screen and have to restart from whatever your last save was. So it was kind of tailor-made for a Sierra experience to be able to have these procedural elements in the game. Anyway, I loved the first Police Quest. I loved the second Police Quest. Police Quest 3, though, to me, was the game that felt like the extra coat of polish on the entire series and really felt like a true next-generation adventure game to me. So just to talk about it a little bit, Police Quest 1 and Police Quest 2 were part of the earlier Sierra adventure titles, meaning they had lower numbers of colors, they had text parser kinds of interfaces. Police Quest 1 would eventually be remade as a VGA release with point-and-click interfaces and all of the other bells and whistles that come along with it, but Police Quest 1 and 2 in their base forms were more primitive. Police Quest 3 was the first game in the series that actually used the newer Sierra technologies to create a game that was much more modern feeling and honestly much more engaging from my perspective, because it actually had the traditional point-and-click gameplay that would become kind of synonymous with adventure games throughout what the golden era of adventure games would eventually become, which for me is like the early to mid-90s is really where, for me, most of my fondest adventure game memories come from. Police Quest 3 was one of those games that really started to push the envelope in that direction, and I remember spending hours playing that game. Not only were the graphics great, not only did the interface feel amazing, but the story. The story here, to me, and looking back on it, it is very dramatic, and it's very kind of almost soap opera-y in a little bit of a way, but I ate it up. I loved it. I love those kind of things. I love how storylines progress over time. I love when there were callbacks to prior things happening in a series. And if you did, in fact, follow the Police Quest series, at least through 1 through 3, because after Police Quest 4, or at Police Quest 4 and beyond, the series kind of went off in a different direction. But for Police Quest 1 through 3, which I guess you could kind of call the trilogy of Sonny Bond's adventures, who Sonny Bond was the main character in the game, that trilogy for me was some of the most fun adventure gaming that I have ever had. I loved every bit of it. And like I said, it even made me want to study outside the game and learn more about police work. If a game can make you take your real life time and spend it thinking about and studying the game, even when you're not playing the game, you know it's something special. We're going to move on to our next game. Let's listen to it and see what it is. What can I say about Myst? Wow, what an amazing looking slideshow. I'm sorry, I'm teasing around. I actually love Myst. I know that it falls under a lot of scrutiny for being really, truly a slideshow, at least in its original format, which has been remade, remastered, and rethunk every single, almost feels like almost every single year since it was originally released, and it's now even in virtual reality, which is kind of insane. But anyway, Myst for me was a very important gaming release because, very similar to Seventh Guest, it was one of those games that truly showed what was technologically possible with the next generation of gaming technology, that being the CD-ROM. I remember the first moments that I stepped onto Myst Island, and I looked around, or clicked around more accurately, and everything around me, the graphics looked, I'm going to say, photorealistic. And I know that looking back at it now, there is not anything photorealistic about that game. But looking at it back when it originally came out in the earlier 90s, it felt like something you had never seen before. There were never graphics like this in any sort of game before Myst came out. And that's probably one of the reasons why many people flocked to it, because they wanted to see what this technological powerhouse was. I was one of those people. The other thing was, as I mentioned a little bit earlier, I love puzzle games. And when I heard about Myst, which was supposedly incredibly difficult and almost confusing to get through, I thought to myself, well, I am going to conquer this game. I am going to sit down and I'm going to use my superior puzzle solving prowess to beat Myst. And I'm not going to use a strategy guide because who uses those? Who needs those? I've been doing these logic puzzles for a long time. And I sat down to play Myst and I couldn't figure out my way off the freaking first island. It was so hard. It was one of those games that I remember literally clicking around for hours trying to figure out what to do. I explored the different buildings on the island. I did make a little bit of progress. I mean, there were some clues that I was able to find. And once again, no spoilers, but there were some clues I was able to find that led me to certain different story points that helped improve my knowledge of what was supposed to be happening. But I gotta tell you, it was super hard. I did eventually make it off of Mist Island. I got onto the first island that, if I remember correctly, requires you to play a specific piece on the piano or piano-like device in Mist, which then opens up a portal to another island, and then you could start exploring that one. I got to that island, and then I also became stuck for hours, not really knowing what to do. The good thing is the graphics were really pretty, and I enjoyed clicking around there, but I never made appreciable progress in Mist, despite loving the concept and despite loving the graphics and the fact that there was, once again, full motion video in the game, which you know I love. I just never really made any progress for Mist. The first time I actually sat down to revisit Mist in any degree of earnestness was around 6-ish years ago when I was hosting my older podcast, which was called Point and Click, an adventure game podcast. And I sat down and I played Mist. And I was determined to not use a strategy guide because, like I mentioned earlier, I'm one of those guys that tries to solve puzzles without any sort of outside help. I will eventually consult a walkthrough for a game if I'm just completely stuck for an unreasonable amount of time. But I'm not the kind of guy that reaches for those walkthroughs right out of the gate. I usually try to bat my head against the wall multiple times before I reach out and scream, yeah, I actually do need help. Well, with Mist, I was determined to not use a strategy guide, and I was doing really well. It was taking me a while, but I was figuring out all of these puzzles. And then there was one point where I could not figure out what to do. And I knew logically what I had to do, but there was no mechanical way that I was aware of in the game that would let me progress. And I gotta tell you what puzzle it is. I'm gonna try to avoid too many spoilers, but it's a puzzle on Mist Island where there's a series of levers. And when you pull the levers, if I'm remembering correctly, it adjusts the numbers that are on the screen. I'm now having a little bit of a visual forgetful moment. But basically, there's two levers. You pull the levers and it changes numbers on the screen. You have to try to get the numbers to line up. And because when you pull the individual levers, the numbers move at a different level of multiple, you can't possibly match those numbers up. You can't possibly solve that puzzle unless you do something mechanically in the game that the game has not told you it can do. Well, I probably would have never figured that out, or maybe I would have figured that out in a moment of frustration and just kind of leaning my forehead against the mouse and magically something would have happened. But I would have never figured out how to solve that puzzle if I didn't go into a walkthrough and actually take a look at it. And once I found that out, you know, sometimes you get that feeling where you look at a walkthrough and you think to yourself, oh, you know what? I could have figured that out. Shame on me for actually quitting too early. Well, with Mist, I didn't feel that issue. I was like, no, shame on you, developers. You didn't teach me that this was even a thing in your game. And I can't believe that you would do that to me. I got a little righteously angry at the time, but I did eventually make my way through the game. But regardless, Mist holds a special place in my heart, not just for my most recent playthrough from years ago, but because when it originally came out, it truly did represent the state of the art in gaming, and I always wanted to be on the forefront of technology. I always wanted to experience all of the good stuff that there was to experience, and when Mist came out and you heard about it everywhere, I knew I had to play it, and whether I beat it or not, which back then I did not, it still made me feel good that I was able to walk around Mist Island, click around, and experience something that everybody else was talking about, and I truly was seeing the future of interactive entertainment. We're going to move on from Mist to talk about our next title, so let's listen to a song from that one.
Thank you.
King's Quest V was actually my first exposure to the King's Quest series by Sierra Online. And I've got to say, King's Quest V holds a special place in my heart. Now, before we talk about this, I do have to mention that I have never sat down to actually beat King's Quest V, but my memories surrounding the purchase of the game and me playing it when I was younger are so vivid that I could not possibly exclude this one from our collection. So let's talk about King's Quest V. I never got the boxed version of the game, and I know that I love big box computer games today. I used to love the big boxes even back then, but I never got a boxed copy of King's Quest V. What I got was a massive collection of CD-ROM discs within which King's Quest V was included. So I remember the moment that I got King's Quest V, and I really didn't know much about King's Quest before this, but I was over at Electronics Boutique, which was, I guess, one of the predecessors to GameStop, but it was effectively very similar to other stores like Babbage's and Software, etc., and if anybody recognizes those names, I would go to Electronics Boutique, and Electronics Boutique was my spot, by the way. I was known on a first-name basis at Electronics Boutique. I was there so much buying all sorts of video and computer games and computer equipment. It was just so much fun. I actually got my first, it was a TNT 2 Ultra, a Riva TNT 2 Ultra video card by, I believe it was a Diamond brand video card. And when I got that 3D accelerator and brought it home, oh my God, I was so excited. And I know this is kind of tangential to King's Quest V, but Electronics Boutique was my spot. And I always went there. I just had a great time. As I walked around Electronics Boutique one day, I saw one of their little columns that I guess was a load-bearing structure in retrospect. But on that column, they had a hang tag area. And on that little hanger, that in one particular day, was literally a bunch of CDs in a plastic, I guess it's almost like a plastic case, very soft plastic case that hung down, and there were like 10 CDs in this collection. And it was just kind of sitting there, hanging there. It was 10 CDs long. The length was literally, I guess, 3 feet long or something like that. Maybe my math is wrong. But regardless, it was hanging there, and I thought, oh my God, there's 10 CDs, 10 different games I can get in this collection? And it was cheap. It was maybe like $15-$20. Wow, this is a value. I have got to pick this up. I looked at it. I saw that there were a bunch of different games. And one that caught my eye was King's Quest V because it had the Roman numeral in the front. And I thought, oh, that's kind of cool. I wonder what that's all about. So I came home. I popped King's Quest V into my disk drive. And what I saw was a level of graphical fidelity that, and maybe not graphical fidelity, but the artistry, I guess is the better way to say it. The artistry of the game and the quality of the graphics that made you really feel like you were playing a fairy tale was something I had not experienced before. And I remember walking around that game world. And back then, I wasn't quite as proficient at adventure games as what I would eventually become. So I never beat the game back when I was younger. And honestly, I haven't even sat down to play it again in the present time either. This is one of those ones that I absolutely will revisit because I have such fond memories of just playing the game. I remember walking around. I remember the Weeping Willow Tree. That is the one memory that is etched in my brain for whatever reason. And I don't know why it's still there. But whenever I think King's Quest V, I think the Weeping Willow Tree. And I don't know that I ever solved the puzzle associated with that tree, but I just remember loving the graphics. I remember loving the environment, the setting, the fairy tale-esque nature of just the entire game. So as I was starting to think about what songs to pick for this episode, I knew that I had to pick the Weeping Willow because it is just one of those memories that's there. Do you ever have that where you have a memory of something and you don't really have a logical reason why you have a memory of it, but you just know it exists indelibly in your brain and it will never go away? I can guarantee you that regardless of if you're talking to me today or in 40 years, if you mention the phrase King's Quest V, my very first thought will be Weeping Willow. And hopefully by then I will have actually played and beaten the game because I'm sure there's a lot of other good stuff there too. But King's Quest V for me just was a perfect combination of fairy tale adventure, music, amazing graphics, and a much simpler time where you could actually lose yourself in a fairy tale and still feel like you were experiencing something truly unique. Moving on from King's Quest V, our next game is a little bit different. Let's talk about that one. The Tex Murphy series, from my perspective, is some of the finest adventure gaming to be had anywhere, anytime. I love Tex Murphy. Now, when I was younger, the first experience I had with Tex Murphy was actually Under a Killing Moon, and you guys are going to notice a theme. I love that game because it had full motion video, which I loved, but I also really enjoyed noir-styled detective games and detective movies and books and things like that. I've always been into the whole concept of private eyes and investigators and detectives and all of that good stuff. So when I saw a game that lets you actually control a private investigator and solve a world-spanning, so to speak, mystery and save the day, you knew I was going to be first in line to try to play that one. And beyond that, the game was super advanced. The original Tex Murphy Under Killing Moon had full motion video. It came on four CDs, and it was the game that made me need to upgrade my computer because inside the box for Tex Murphy Under Killing Moon was a small piece of paper, and it said, hey, look at these graphics if you're running the game on 4 megabytes of RAM. And yes, I said megabytes. And of course, at that time, I was running the game on 4 megabytes of RAM. I looked at it and it was kind of a pixely mess. You couldn't really tell all the details and things like that. And then at the bottom said, look at what the game looks like if you're running it on, I believe it was 16 megabytes of RAM. Might have been 12 megabytes. I think it was 16 though, because 16 feels like a better number than 12 in the whole megabyte numbering scheme. But I think the bottom of the picture said, look what you could do if you ran the game in 16 megabytes or with 16 megabytes of RAM. And everything looked super clear. And I thought to myself, oh, this is an upgrade that I need to get. So I went to my father and I said, hey, Dad, I need more RAM. And he said, what? And I said, well, no, in the computer, there's a thing called RAM. We need more memory. And he said, what's that? I said, I don't really know, but it makes the game run better. So eventually we went to a computer show. And computer shows, by the way, is another unlocked memory that I probably could spend hours talking about. I loved going to computer shows and just wandering the floors of these large convention centers where you had a bunch of different semi-reputable, maybe sometimes not so reputable, vendors selling all sorts of stuff from computer hardware to software to games in jewel cases, which, by the way, this is another tangential kind of story. I mentioned before that I love big box computer games. I have a pretty large collection of big box computer games. And of course, as part of our normal podcast episodes, I always look at the back of the box for any of the games that we talk about. Well, at computer shows, I would often wonder, look, I'm looking at these games and I could buy the big box version for like $40, or I could buy the jewel case version for $10. What the heck's going on? Why is there such a disparity? Well, at the time, I didn't recognize that software piracy was absolutely rampant, and most likely a lot of those jewel case-based games were simple copies of the games that were clever counterfeits as opposed to actual real-life copies of the game. It didn't matter to me at that point. I equated the fact that, hey, I could get four times as many of those as I could a single big box game. So when I went to computer shows, I would often look through the cardboard boxes full of jewel case games just to try to find if there were anything cool in there and see if there were some collections I could pick up and add to my own personal collection. Now, one of the other things about computer shows, by the way, is that they had a very large number of adult-only titles, which were all labeled XXX right above those cardboard boxes. And I'm not going to lie, there were occasions where, oh no, I went to the wrong box and I accidentally flipped through some, oh no, my bad, I didn't realize. Of course, I was a young teenager at the time, and the internet wasn't really as much of a thing as what it is now, so we'll leave it at that. Anyway, Tex Murphy. I loved Under a Killing Moon, and I enjoyed playing that game so much that I bought the strategy guide. And I know I mentioned before that I didn't use the strategy guide for actual, I didn't like using strategy guides to try to walk through the game. I didn't do that with Under a Killing Moon. I beat Under a Killing Moon without the strategy guide. I bought the strategy guide because I loved the game so much that I just wanted to read the strategy guide after I beat the game. I wanted to continue to experience the Tex Murphy world. Even though I had already beaten the game, I thought having the strategy guide just and reading it and looking at all the puzzles again and the screenshots and everything else like that. And they also had some story in there too. It was kind of written not just as a pure strategy guide. There had some lore and story in there as well. I absolutely loved it. I read that strategy guide cover to cover probably a couple times in between actually playing Under a Killing Moon multiple times. I just loved it so much. This song, though, that I chose is not from Under a Killing Moon. It is from the Pandora Directive, which was the next Tex Murphy adventure. And it is chronologically the fourth Tex Murphy adventure. There was Mean Streets and Martian Memorandum, which had predated the FMV goodness of Under a Killing Moon. But the Pandora Directive was everything Under a Killing Moon was, but bigger and better and more detailed. Everything, the quality was so much higher. And like I said, I loved Under a Killing Moon, but I loved Pandora Directive even more. And I remember the moment that this song plays in the game. So let me paint you the picture. You, as always, are Tex Murphy, a kind of bumbling private investigator who gets involved in a case involving a killer, a serial killer that is targeting young women. And it is your job to try to find that killer before he strikes again. So you're across the street on the roof of a building. You look through your binoculars and you see that your client, the person that hired you, is about to be attacked by this killer. So you rush down, you rush inside of, I think it was the Fuchsia Flamingo was the nightclub. You rush in there, you jump into the room and you save the day. The Black Arrow killer, who was the main serial killer in the game, he gets away. Well, you have to give chase. You look all around. You eventually make your way onto the roof of the nearby buildings, and then a cutscene plays where Tex jumps down from the roof, attacks the Black Arrow killer, and they have what in my child mind was the most epic one-on-one fist fight ever. As this music played in the background, as the music for the game that I just chose for the track just played in the background. And I remember thinking, oh my God, I am on the edge of my seat. Literally, I just thinking about it now, and I haven't played Pandora Directive in a while, but just thinking about it now, I'm kind of getting excited about it. I'm like, I remember in my head that moment of when they were both fighting each other. And I thought to myself, yeah, Tex, go get him left and a right. And I guess I was a little bit of a weird child. I probably still am a little bit, but it was just such an amazing experience. And that was the moment, by the way, that I thought from a full motion video perspective, okay, this stuff is getting to be near movie level. Now, retrospectively, that's not necessarily true, I guess, but it was a truly impactful moment for me as I played the game. And I just remember thinking, wow, Tex, what a stud. And I am going to venture a guess and say that nobody has ever said those words about Tex Murphy before. But when I played Pandora Directive, I was so enamored with the game. And that scene in particular, I will truly never forget. Moving on to our next game, let's listen to this track and see if you can guess where it comes from. I know this might not be the most popular pick, but Phantasmagoria holds a special place in my heart. Once again, another full motion video adventure game, but this one is a little bit different because it was designed by the legendary game designer Roberta Williams, and it was also a much more mature adventure game. It was a horror game. It had blood. It had guts. It even had mature sexual content in it. And for somebody that I guess when it was released was probably 14 years old or so, I thought, oh, this is like being an adult playing this game. And I know kids have weird thoughts, but it really was something I thought. I was like, oh, this is something that is really adult entertainment, and I'm playing it. I feel like such a big shot right now. Phantasmagoria tells the story of what is effectively a haunted mansion kind of thing. You play as Adrian, a young woman who moves into this house with their husband, and as you might imagine, things aren't really what they seem, and things kind of go off the rails relatively quickly in that game. The reason I remember Phantasmagoria is because, like I said, it was one of the more mature titles that had, at least from my perspective, really ever been released up to that point. The fact that it had full motion video enthralled me, but even more than that, this is the game that really felt, for the first time, like I was playing a horror film. And I love horror movies, by the way. I love all kinds of movies, but I've always enjoyed horror movies, and I particularly enjoy horror movies that involve some element of possession. The scariest movie of all time, from my standpoint, is The Exorcist, which I saw at a way too young age and has actually scarred me for life, but that also set off a lifelong enjoyment, or at least a lifelong feeling that those kind of movies are really intriguing for some reason. And any movie that has possession in it, by the way, sign me up. I'm all there for it, and I will typically really enjoy them, even if the movie themselves are not that great. Phantasmagoria does have a possession element in there. It talks about this evil entity that does start to cause havoc in everybody's life, and it really felt to me like playing one of those horror movies that I always enjoyed as a kid and even continue to enjoy as an adult. Looking at the game from a retrospective analysis, it's probably not the best adventure game out there. And I know that some people out on Discord have even said, oh, I can't get into this at all. I don't know what to tell you. It's still something that holds a special place in my heart. The memories of playing that game when I was younger. And a lot of times I would play this game actually before school. I would go in to the room that we had our computer in. I would sit down. I'd fire up the game. The lights would all be off because I've always been a morning person. By the way, if I haven't mentioned that, I'm a morning person. I would wake up at 4 o'clock in the morning just to be able to have some time to myself. Even as a kid, I used to love playing games in the morning before any sane person would actually be awake. So I'd wake up at around 4 o'clock. I'd go into the room that we had our computer in. I'd keep the lights off. I'd plug my headphones in. And the only light coming from that room would be the light of the computer monitor as I played whatever game I was playing. And Phantasmagoria was one that definitely monopolized days of my time back then when I was originally playing it. Now, I don't know if anybody has ever tried to play a horror game when everything is dark, it's dark outside, everything is quiet, and all you have are headphones on, especially if you tried to do that when you were a kid. If you did, and you were like me, you might have noticed, or maybe imagined, or maybe not, some disturbing things happening in real life. And I don't know if this is something unique to me. I'm assuming it's not. But when I played this game as a kid, I remember very vividly the feeling that for whatever reason, I wasn't alone. Even though I was alone in the room, it was so early in the morning, so dark, there was nothing else going on in the house. And I kept feeling like I would hear these creaks around. And it got into my head. This game got into my head and made me kind of get creeped out. And even thinking about it right now, I got a little bit of goosebumps and a chill up my spine thinking about, oh, that was kind of scary. Now, in reality, I'm sure there wasn't any sort of evil entity or presence there sitting with me playing Roberta Williams' latest adventure. But the fact that I started to feel that feeling is a testament to the fact that Phantasmagoria as a game was actually pretty darn effective. I enjoyed it a lot. And it just felt to me like the perfect combination of interactive gameplay and horror movie elements and mature themes that for a teenager around that time that had grown up primarily with Nintendo-based systems and all of the cutesy, pixely goodness that come with that, and we were just now starting to see more mature kinds of content, that to me felt like I was seeing the future of what computer games would eventually become, and video games in general would eventually become. It turns out, in reality, it kind of was, because the stuff we have today is not necessarily considered simple children's entertainment anymore. It is now for all of us. And the fact that I am sitting here today as a 42-year-old guy talking to you about video and computer games is a testament to that fact. Anyway, that is going to be the last song and game for today's episode. I hope you've all enjoyed listening to these tracks and hearing a little bit about my own personal anecdotes surrounding these games, because for me, music is undeniably linked with the gaming experiences that I've had and the personal memories I've formed while playing those games. Oftentimes, when I think back on a fond memory, the first thing that comes to mind is the music that was playing in the background when that moment occurred. And that same exact phenomenon happens whenever I reminisce about a favorite game I may have played. Music has the ability to transport you back to simpler times, or to situations that, for whatever reason, left an indelible mark upon your personality and life. While that phenomenon certainly applies to traditional everyday life, it also applies to our collective gaming experiences, and as I sat here listening through these tracks, I've become filled with a sense of comfort and nostalgia that feels remarkably soothing. And it's amazing to me that music, perhaps more than any other medium, can accomplish that psychological feat. Whether you're a fan of game music or you listen to alternate soundtracks while you're enjoying your personal favorite games, the fact is that music in general is an art form that enhances the experiences we've all had throughout our collective lives. And that, undoubtedly, deserves to be celebrated. was our episode celebrating the sounds of the classics, Point and Click Adventures, Volume 1. I hope you all enjoyed listening to it as much as I enjoyed creating it. If you'd like to reach out, let me know how I'm doing, provide feedback, comments, suggestions, or just talk about classic games and technology in general, I would love to hear from you, and there are a few ways you can reach out. I have an X account with the handle @ClassicGamingT. I have an email address, which is ClassicGamingToday@gmail.com, and we have a Discord server. The link is in the show notes. Discord is the best way to get in touch with me and the rest of the community around this podcast. We have a ton of fun out on Discord. I highly encourage you all to check it out. And once again, our next Sounds of the Classics episode in 10 episodes is going to be a listener grab bag episode, so definitely send those responses in. At the same time, I'd like to encourage everyone to check out our Patreon. It is patreon.com/classicgamingtoday. If you want even more Classic Gaming Today goodness, including a bi-weekly exclusive Patreon podcast expansion pack, patreon.com/classicgamingtoday is where it's at. Before we sign off for the week, I do want to mention that our next episode is going to be focused on Castlevania, so feel free to write in if you have any particularly fond or not so fond memories of that experience. At the same time, I recognize you're likely listening to this podcast on any number of podcast services and engines, and if you would feel so inclined, it would be great if you could leave me a review. This is not about bolstering star counts, this is not about trying to harvest a ton of 5-star ratings, though if that happens, awesome, it means we're doing something right. No, what it's really all about is trying to deliver the best possible podcast I can. The only way to do that is to get feedback from all of you, the listener community, to make sure I am hitting the mark. We get new listeners every single day, which is absolutely amazing. I want to make sure I can continue to deliver the content that everyone wants to listen to. We'll be back in around a week with our next episode focused on Castlevania. Until then, remember, sometimes the games of the past are just as good, if not better, than the games of today. Goodbye, everyone.